and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan-Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. Each week, our two offices come together to celebrate the people and processes that operate behind the scenes to make creative work happen, as well as some of the thoughts and tools that are shaping our industry. While we have a certain focus on advertising, illustration, and animation, the topics and ideas discussed here will be of universal value to anyone who creates anything at all, really. This podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as a bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence, no matter what the medium. This week, we're taking a deep dive into the segment we have until now been calling our mini-link section. As with our other episodes, each of us will be picking a link that we have either posted or read about in our professional development Slack channel, but instead of just a cursory overview, we'll be devoting an entire episode to some more in-depth discussion between the three of us and allow our unique working styles and personality to show through. Ooh, I think one of my favorite things about doing this podcast is the chance it offers me to chat about this with the two of you, because not only are we in different geographic locations that give us different industry perspectives, but we also have very kind of different ways of looking at the world and our work. And also we're of three different age brackets as well. So I think that also kind of offers some really good points of difference there.
I'm still the wisest.
this is true. We're planning on doing these episodes every couple of weeks to break up the interviews, as well as to give us some more space to tease out some of the more exploratory content that we've heard you enjoy. Before we jump in, though, I should say we really, really need a better name for this segment and feature. So if you can think of a good one, we will name the next mini link episode after you. Your name will be in lights. It'll be, well, on the title of the podcast, maybe even in the podcast artwork itself. So send in your suggestions to podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you want to submit a link, article, or request for something that we should cover as well, let us know there as well. So to that end, let's just get stuck into it. Lara, you're going to get things started. Tell us what you have chose. What have you brought to show and tell?
I have brought to show and tell. This is a link that came up a bit earlier this week. I found it through some other article I was reading. I can't even remember that now. It didn't make too much of an impression, I guess, but she sort of mentioned this and, you know, you go in that internet rabbit hole. And I ended up on a website called Career Contessa.
It's a Contessa.
I don't know. All I know is the Barefoot Contessa. Yeah, is it the same?
Is it the same thing?
I'm going to Google Contessa.
Okay, let's do this.
Okay. So while you Google Contessa, I'm going to tell you a bit more about this site. Basically, it's basically an advice site that's focused on helping women cultivate successful careers. And they have a range of really amazing content, and I definitely recommend looking into it. But today I want to focus on specifically their Hire a Mentor service, because I don't know, I think it's a really cool offering and I didn't know it existed until like 3 days ago. So basically they've sort of built up this vetted and verified database of some seriously incredible female professionals who you can hire to provide one-on-one mentoring. And so you can sort of read all about their job experience and their advice specialties and, you know, to sort of help you pick the right mentor for you. And from what I can tell, they sort of range in price from around $90 to $200 for the hour. So for example, some of the people that you can hire are like the head of talent and culture at Amaze, although I hate Amaze because I didn't win the competition to be Idris Elba's Valentine's date. you could pick the senior technical recruiter at Uber, which might be problematic, but I don't know, maybe they're a new recruiter, or the global recruiting manager from Stripe. There's some just really, really interesting stuff in there. And there's a lot of sort of just career coaches and stuff, but also people who are in really amazing positions. So I don't know, I really like this idea as both a way for, you know, ambitious people to have access to knowledgeable people, and also as a way for these talented women to make money from sharing their time and knowledge.
Yeah, definitely for their value, well, for their time to be valued.
Totally. But I guess what I wonder a bit is what you miss out on by engaging in a service like this rather than building up a more organic relationship with a regular mentor. And like I wouldn't say that I've ever had a formal mentor. Have you guys ever had a formal mentor?
I mean, I would never say that I've sought out one, but I definitely have people in my life, and I have someone in my life that I would kind of call my mentor.
I'm right here, Bianca. It's okay.
No, but I mean, I like early on in my career, I had the opportunity to work with an incredible executive producer for a couple of years. And named Hamish McDonald. Shout out to you. And, you know, I studied design and I had no idea what a producer was until I landed a studio management role in this position. And, you know, he kind of, I mean, it was kind of his job to teach me, but at the same time, he really did take me under his wing. And especially in an industry that's filled with pretty dominant creative personalities who are usually male, he was a really great kind of person for me to have. And you know, we've kind of continued like more of a formal mentorship sort of and friendship, I guess, like after.
Right, because that's the part I'm interested in, the sort of more formal part, and specifically someone who's like maybe outside of your company, you know, where it's not their job to do that. Like I've definitely, like you, had incredible people in senior positions who have taken the time to give me advice and guidance that was enormously helpful. But I've never had someone that like with whom I'd have like regular meetings to discuss my career and like measure my progression, and someone who's been like really invested in that way. And I think it's like definitely one of those things I'd love to explore and people always tell you to, but like honestly, I'm a bit stunned when people tell me that they're in those sorts of relationships, because I kind of can't imagine how anyone could be generous enough to sort of donate that amount of time and advice for free on like a regular basis to help a junior without any rewards. Is that just super cynical? They're everywhere.
No. Look, I mean, I looked at this slide and that, like there's something about it that I don't know. Like I think the word mentorship is being a bit, I don't want to say bastardized. Maybe that's not the right word for this situation, but it's, I don't know. It just seems like there's this huge buzz around it. And I think, or maybe I've just been listening to Tim Ferriss. He's got that new book, Tribe of Mentors, which has two of my least favorite words at the moment, tribe and mentors, where it's just kind of like, I feel that mentorship is a real kind of sacred thing that really shouldn't have, I guess, a financial exchange around it. It's a real sacred relationship. And I think, you know, I talk about my mentor being Alyssa at Point Five, you know, who, you know, it was never kind of a formal kind of mentorship in that kind of state at the time that I was doing it when I was around 15. But I definitely would say that she is my mentor, you know, into this day in many ways, even though we don't have an active, we don't have kind of an active mentor-mentee relationship. She's someone that I kind of look to as kind of a role model as well. And so like, I consider her a mentor in a way that like, well, I try to model myself off of her, or she kind of inspires me in that way, kind of, you know, similar to like a godparent, you know, a very kind of similar thing. I kind of feel like, yeah, like if you were saying, okay, I'll be your godparent for $200 an hour, well, you're just a babysitter, you know?
Yeah, totally.
It's like, so I don't know, like if these are mentors, like rather than just kind of,
or is it consultation?
Yeah. Like, and again, I don't know if I'm kind of being too kind of semantic here, but I do think the idea of kind of commodifying this thing is just rubs me the wrong way. I don't know. Like
I don't think there's a bad thing about commodifying it if you're phrasing it correctly in that you are paying for a consultation with a successful, like I think that's okay.
And that seems to be what's happening here. Yeah. And look, I do applaud the site for, they have some amazing diversity of background, experience, and individuals. Like, so I feel like there's the people here are really kind of talented. And it says, you know, expertise, it looks like they're kind of outlining certain things that you can kind of learn. And I think having that kind of one-to-one contact is, you know, there is kind of a high barrier to entry to find mentors or to find people to help. But at the same time, I don't know, like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? The more I kind of think about a lot of my responses to these pieces, the more I kind of feel like I'm shaking my fist at those damn kids, because like I don't know, it's kind of something where like there has to be like a trade-off where things are really hard to get, I think they become a bit more kind of valuable. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, especially like within, you know, you look at kind of music and streaming services, yeah, there's pluses and minuses, but I remember when music was harder to find, like you valued it more, it was like you had to kind of seek it out, go through these kind of different ways
back in my day.
And you just got to taste my Australian accent. Yeah.
I mean, I think in you know, in my case, like the formality of it didn't really sort of start until my mentor, who I was working with at the time, left the company. And then but he was working at a different studio only 5 minutes up the road. So we made an effort to catch up every couple of weeks. And, you know, he's probably almost 10 years my senior. And I think like, you know, he's opened a lot of doors for me, but only because I have so much respect for him, and I have respect for like our relationship, and you know, it's for me, it's like I put the effort in with him and I put myself out there, and he's never handed anything to me. I was always prepared, always grateful for his time. So there's a really like nice relationship that has happened organically, that is built around respect and mutual respect and helping each other out, that doesn't maybe happen in a financial exchange.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, like, though, I mean, Jeremy, I'm sure I've heard you before sort of champion the idea of finding a mentor, someone like that. Mm. But I guess what I wonder is, like, how do you suggest that people go about actually finding one? Like, because, like, let's say you work with someone or you know of someone that you admire and you respect and you would love their sort of input and advice. Are you meant to just sort of, like, wait for them to offer or?
No, I think you have to. I mean, I've been formally asked to mentor people before.
Have you done it?
Yeah. And it's been like an amazing, rewarding thing that I've always flattered to kind of be asked. And yeah, it's one of the best things I think you can do, like, as a professional. But yeah, it has to be done in a considered way. But I kind of think another thing as well, like, we were talking about this with student interviews and things like that. Like, a lot of people who are kind of higher profile will have already information out there that's already kind of helpful, you know, to know. And so I kind of think that to first find someone who you are kind of interested in, you respect, and do your kind of research first, and don't kind of go straight and saying, like, okay, you know, will you be my mentor?
Take this, Rose.
Right. But yeah, like, you know, try to do kind of the research first. And then, like, you know, when you start hitting specific roadblocks, like, that's where you can kind of start going to kind of coaching. I think there's a difference between someone who's a junior and kind of needs a mentor to get to the next stage, and someone who needs, I guess, business advice and how to get through kind of certain specific roadblocks, which actual individual sessions are, you know, great at doing. Like, you know, it's the stuff that we spoke about with Joe here in previous episode with Joanne Hook. So I think if you're in the first position where you're someone kind of young, and you need to kind of get that experience, like, yes, mentorship is great. If you got to go about it the right way, and I don't feel like there should be a financial exchange. But if you're someone who's has been in business a while, needs kind of something specific to go and a roadblock to get past, and you haven't done that before, platforms like this are great.
And you're looking essentially for a consultant. Like, if you want to ask, like, okay, how should I go about asking for a salary rise or blah, 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 then perhaps someone
And getting that advice is really hard. And also, like, finding people who give that advice is hard. Mm-hmm. And I think, look, having this kind of vetted system here and having reviews especially is also really helpful. So much of the consultancy network is all based around word of mouth. And it's also a very personal thing that revolves around chemistry like any other business relationship. So look, I think it's a great thing. I'm glad you brought this to the table. And just to confirm, but Contessa is, well, it's a show on Philippine television.
Oh, of course. That's where it comes from.
But also just an Italian countess.
Yes.
There you go. Oh, and by the way, I didn't mention this at the top, but we will be putting the links to all these in our show notes. So yeah, anything that we're talking about, the piece himself, as any kind of related links that we kind of come up in our own kind of research and discussion, that will be on our podcast page at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Okay, going across the big pond. Is it called the big pond, or is that just Telstra's internet service?
I never thought of those as linked.
Well, because it's like across the pond.
Isn't that to Europe?
Yeah, to Europe, like between America and Europe.
Oh, so it's a bigger pond.
Between America and Europe, not between Australia. Do we have any?
No, but the big pond is maybe between Australia and America.
I don't want to buzz market Telstra here, but
I'm going to Google. You guys talk.
Okay. B, what do you got?
I mean, last week we talked about the email charter, which was created in response to widespread acknowledgement that email is getting out of hand for many people. And Jeremy, you screamed, the email problem is real. And I've just been thinking so much about email lately. I think maybe because we're sort of easing back into the new year after, you know, a couple of weeks off for Christmas or whatever. I just find it so completely bizarre that we spend so much of our working day dealing with email. You know, like, sometimes I feel like my job is no longer to be a producer, to be an agent. It's just an email manager. And I guess from this, like, I was listening to a few things, like a great podcast, which we've mentioned a couple of times on the show, called Hurry Slowly. And there was an episode with Jason Fried, which I listened to on the subway the other day.
Just quickly,
Who's Schedule?
Is it Fried or Fried? Because it's spelt Fried. I think he's just done weird PR thing trying to make sure that his name isn't pronounced Fried.
It's Fried.
Okay, keep going.
Like Mrs. Bouquet, Mrs. Bucket.
B, go on.
Anyway, so I was listening to Hurry Slowly. Interview guest was Jason Fried, who is someone that talks a lot about time management and energy management, and, you know, kind of was saying that there's right now far too much communication moving around. It's not work anymore. I think a lot of people are just spending a lot of their day responding. So, you know, he kind of likes to end the day thinking, did you actually get any work done, or did you just spend your day responding? And I guess I'm so curious, because I got onto another tangent about another Atlantic article, which was about how it became normal to ignore texts and emails.
What was this about?
This was about more about the anxiety of leaving things unanswered and the expectation to answer, and how easy it is to, like, now that we have, I guess, like the smartphone in our pocket and it's easy to immediately respond to someone. And when they don't respond, the anxiety around that, but also that kind of like, sorry for the delayed response. And ignoring and procrastinating on messages just because we're just getting so much overload of communication. I'm just curious for you guys. I mean, what has been the one thing that maybe you've implemented in the last couple of months that's helped with your email overload?
Oh, I mean, without a doubt for me, it's this I think came from Jeremy, but it's also like just a general technique that everyone spouts, but it's real. Just turning my emails into items on my to-do list instead of just like leaving them to fester in my inbox. So like anything that can be dealt with in under 3 minutes, you fire it off then and there. And anything else that needs more time to sort of assess and respond to, you add it to your to-do list, which for me is Wunderlist. And then I sort of assign it a certain priority level. And then, you know, usually I'll also fire off a very quick response to each email to, you know, thank the person, let them know I'm on it, or get back to them in roughly X amount of time. And from there, I often even like archive the email and I only actually look it up, you know, when I get to that point on my to-do list of responding to it. So it's not just sitting there. Although sometimes like I do leave it there if I need an extra strong reminder, or if I know I'm going to get to it really soon. But I think like firstly, pulling them out of my inbox and just reducing the number of emails I have sitting there just helps me psychologically. Like even though my to-do list.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cause then like I know that then my to-do list might be really long. And some people say like, what's the point if it just makes your to-do list longer? But that is at least like this sort of easy to digest, actionable list that I can tick off systematically throughout my day. Whereas a giant,
and I guess you're adding to the to-do list, whereas your inbox is people adding to your to-do list.
Yeah, totally. I think that's part of it as well. And I think like a giant bunch of emails that are sort of just staring at me while they sort of stagnate in my inbox is really overwhelming and not really helpful. And it just sort of makes me feel like I'm drowning in things that I need to tackle, but it gives me no real sense of the actual scale of those things. So like my brain just sort of assumes it's far more extreme than it actually is.
Look, the email charter, this is one of my favorite pieces of internet writing that I've seen in this year, which hasn't been that long, maybe for the last 12 like months,
30
for a long
days.
Time. I mean, we talked about it, was it last week or the week before? I don't know when.
It was last week.
Last week. But yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up because I think there's so much more that we kind of can go into. And it's really tricky because I think that, yeah, sometimes like I really get so exhausted writing emails and I just want to have kind of phone calls or do it kind of, you know, with my voice, and hence the system I was proposing last week. But it's so tricky in our industry because we're usually talking about projects, there's so many moving parts and we need to have written records of it because people often, you know, don't catch things, and we need, like, it's like we're not lawyers, but we need things in writing just kind of the same.
Honestly, maybe I'm in the minority here.
Yes.
I don't find email itself that stressful.
I think I'm just getting bored of writing. I think that's what I'm responding to.
For me, like I think where our perspectives will really kind of change as well, because like a lot of the writing that I have to do is a lot more kind of emotional, like, you know, in terms of like, you know, not logistical, like where I'm trying to support, you know, artists through kind of difficult times, or I'm trying to kind of, you know, like by the time an email comes to me, it's at a level where, you know, maybe it is very kind of hard, like, you know, either something that you need to kind of push up the chain. So a lot of the stuff that I'm dealing with is hard and so just mentally kind of taxing. And it's also really fun. The thing that's, I thought funny about this, this email charter piece as well, is that it kind of put things in front of me that I realized I did that were kind of not positive, yeah, or maybe not helping other people. And I think the biggest one is number four, which is quash open-ended questions. And I think and this is going to actually change the way that I kind of, you know, train producers as well. Cause a lot of the systems, it's great to hear that have been kind of working for you and other people, but things like, I'm like, okay, yeah, how do we get the email out of the inbox as fast as possible? And sometimes it's like, okay, spin the plate, put it back in their court, ask a question, because 9 out of 10 times is never enough information in the email to begin with. And now I'm kind of realizing, oh, maybe that isn't kind of, you know, as respectful as that could be towards kind of someone else's time. But at the same time, yeah, like it really requires the other person to be, you know, like things like not having questions answered when you kind of clearly outline things, like that's hard as well. So I guess really that, I don't know, that's, I think everyone's been trying to solve this question with different tech as well. Like, you know, is like email is broken. Like, how do we fix it? Well, Slack was supposed to be the answer. And now it seems like we have like, you know, 100 more inboxes and kind of more emails.
Yeah. I mean, I don't find email in itself problematic for me. I mean, writing comes naturally to me and it's definitely my sort of preferred mode of communication. So like that's not the part I find stressful. What I find stressful is the time pressures of the particular industry that we work in. And I'm sure that's common across many industries, and the expectation that you'll respond in, you know, instantly. But I think if that were alleviated, email wouldn't really bother me at all. Like I like reading, I like writing, and I enjoy carefully crafting my correspondence.
I love that as
well. Great. I'm just going to delegate all of my emails to you, Lara.
All right.
Congratulations.
You can take all the rest of the crap that I don't want to do. I don't want to sit on the phone with people for ages. I don't find that enjoyable.
You know what it is as well? Like the reason email is hard for me, woe is me on all my email issues. But it's like, it's such a huge part of what we do. I think I talked about like my people-pleasing tendencies as well. And Bianca linked an article. It was like, I tried emailing like a CEO and quite frankly, it made my life better. And oh my God, I wish I could do it.
No, that was ridiculous. I hated it.
But we have a lot of clients and people we deal with like that.
We don't like them at all. They don't give us any of the information we need. They don't read our emails properly. They're terrible people. I think that can work in certain situations, but that article took those emails totally out of context. This person tried to apply them to everything for the sake of an amusing BuzzFeed article. And I think you can only write emails like that when they're, you know, specific context, meaning, you know, the relationship you have with the person you're writing to calls for it.
Exactly. I couldn't do it because I think a lot of it is like a real kind of dick power move. Like people are kind of like, you know,
it's awful.
Yeah, no, it's totally awful. But I think what I'm trying to say though is that the fundamental flaw of email that makes it stressful is how hard it is to communicate what your tone and intention is. And like that, well, you see, yeah, I think for people like you who are more skilled writers, like that does come a bit naturally. And that's why I think writing is so important as a producer or anyone kind of working in creativity, because you're trying to get all these amorphous kind of thoughts between people. And if your words are the vehicle for that information, yeah, it has to be kind of right. So yeah, look, I think email's hard.
Well, like, wouldn't that issue still exist in speech? Like you just don't care in speech if it comes across properly, or
this is very, you know, it's true. I mean, even having the, you know, even just like before, like I was trying to make my point and I realized I couldn't because I didn't have the words.
Exactly.
To do it.
I think that's why I prefer emailing half the time, is because like I get the opportunity to really say what I'm trying to say in the way that I want to say it, compared to when I pick up the phone and I'm just like, blah.
I think, look, the email problem is real. It's a great kind of top line summary for this. I think we could literally spend an episode on each of these kind of points and kind of talk about it. And because there are I think when I look at our training manual, like so much that we kind of put into how we write emails and like, you know, what our kind of style is and, you know, all those kind of things. And I think these points are just so important to keep in mind. Oh, the other article I want to add to this, B, I don't know if you can do that, is on the ever amazing, always amazing Fast Company blog. This was out this week and quite timely. They found an email from Steve Jobs and kind of deconstructed it.
Oh, yes.
Did you find
we
that?
Should actually, yeah. You're pulling another Jeremy.
We all read the Fast Company blog. We all read, that's like the one thing we all agree on.
I don't know. But we don't all claim that they've found. Anyway, keep
anyway,
going.
So apparently, and this is interesting, there isn't that much kind of public record of Steve Jobs' emails. And so this email kind of came out because of a court case. And he was dealing with fellow lovely Australian James Packer, was it? Maybe?
No, it was Murdoch.
Oh, one of the really rich Australian people. Anyway, about like the book deal for kind of for iBooks. And it was amazing. They just kind of did a bit of a forensic overview on how he constructed the email. And like, it was actually really pleasing to see how we have automatically been doing a lot of those things because
it's a beautifully like constructed email. We are basically Apple. Yes, that is correct. I love that piece. I love that email. It's a masterpiece. That email is beautiful. Like it's manipulative, but in a friendly, fair way. And I love that.
I like the bit about addressing the recipient by their name. And I thought that was a bit tricky though, because that's always kind of something. It reads to me sometimes like the equivalent of being called mate, which is probably my least favorite thing ever. Like, you know, I don't know.
I love being called mate. Calling people mate. It depends how you say it. Because you're American, you don't get it.
When you hear an email, it's the worst.
What?
Okay, we'll move on from there. The third and final link is the one that I picked this week from Campaign Brief, the local ad news rag that gives us news and endless amazing anonymous comments. Now, this article, I thought the reason that I kind of picked it just kind of came off the back of our chat last week with Grace from 4Card. And it talks about how Alex Bogusky from Kristen Porter and Bogusky, quite a large U.S. ad agency, has invested in a influencer platform called Influence.co. And yeah, there's some Australian agencies kind of also investing in this as well. And I just kind of, I thought it would be just good to talk about because, again, similar to the whole kind of mentorship, not kind of debacle or debate, but like I feel that especially even after kind of talking to Grace about kind of influencers and what her kind of platform does, it remains kind of something that I'm really kind of feel just unsure about. Like it's something that I don't really kind of understand it. And so it just seems like so many kind of platforms are popping up as well. Like I'm just reading these articles kind of every day about a different kind of person investing in it or a different kind of team kind of, you know, launching it. And I think, you know, what really crystallized for me after talking to Grace was really kind of what these platforms are, kind of like media booking platforms, you know? So again, instead of kind of booking a certain billboard in a certain space, you're able to kind of hyper-focus it and you're kind of able to really kind of place your quote unquote content, you know, with a person who then gets that your brand message out that way through their kind of followers. And I guess, yeah, we talked about some of the more kind of cynical aspects of this. But I guess one thing that I was kind of thinking of is the Venn diagram of good, fast, and cheap, you know, that we talk about a lot when kind of we're dealing with kind of clients. And I feel in...
Should we explain that?
Oh, yeah. The Venn diagram is basically, well, not really a Venn diagram, but it's kind of, there's a good website we need to find that has the kind of switches. And so, you know, clients always come to you and say they want something good, fast, and cheap. And, you know, the creative would go back and say, yeah, you can have two. You can have things fast and good, but it won't be cheap. You can have things slow and cheap, but it won't be, you know what I mean? Anyway. And so I feel like now a new, I guess influencer marketing is kind of putting this new layer on things where they have to be good, fast, and cheap and have 10,000 followers, you know? Like we're getting briefs in where it's like, you know, the artist is kind of perfect, but like, you know, they want it now posted to their channel. So I feel it's like, it's, I don't know how to kind of feel about it. And I just kind of wanted to suss it out with you guys here. But what I'm curious about most of, do you know any influencers actually, like personally?
I mean, it depends how you like grade an influencer, but there's this girl that I used to work with at La Porchetta when I was like 14. But she seems to have since then, like over the last 10, 15 years, become an influencer of some sort. She runs this fashion Instagram, I guess that's what you call it, with another girl. And I just checked right before we started recording and they have 62,900 followers. Like that's a lot, right? That's way more than us. I mean, it seems like a lot to me. And I mean, I have no idea if they make, you know, much or any money. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that they both still have day jobs. But I always see them going to these sort of launch dinners and stuff where they have like really fancy food. So like, that's good, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. We manage artists with fairly large followings and, you know, we negotiate and campaigns and we leverage, which leverage their audience on the behalf of our clients. So yes, I mean, I guess we know influencers within the creative space and they definitely, it's another part of their income, but maybe in a different way. But I mean, I have a few friends here that are friends with fairly high profile fashion influencers, that, you know, definitely earn a living from being an influencer and, you know, have made a legitimate career out of, collaborating with brands and partnering with brands through their social network and their clout and their influence. But
surely that thing not sustainable. Like, you know, like I wouldn't be able to go to sleep at night, like knowing that kind of my career. I mean, even though our career and our kind of work is based on trends as much as kind of anything. And
we work in advertising.
Yeah, I know. That causes me great stress. but yeah, like, I don't know. Like, I'm kind of curious to know if like any, like, you know, who uses kind of these platforms and how it's kind of being managed. Like, it seems to me like we're kind of fighting it out at the moment, like to wait for kind of one platform to emerge. And that was what was funny about this press release is like, well, yeah, we think this is going to be the one that's going to do it. Or, you know, and maybe we will, maybe we won't, but it just seems kind of so fragmented at the moment. Like, I don't know. Is it just me not kind of understanding things?
I don't think it's complex necessarily to understand why they exist. Like, you know, influencer deals, as you were saying, when they're like, sort of approached correctly, they're clearly, I mean, this is completely separate to whether you think it's like ethically right or wrong, right? Completely separate. Just in like a bottom line sort of point of view, it is a great way of targeting specific consumers and then converting them into actual paying customers. So it's only natural then that agencies, you know, to manage those deals are going to start popping up. I think like the very nature of influencer marketing being that like each influencer reaches a very specific segment of an audience means that there are millions of them out there with, you know, millions more coming out of the woodwork sort of every day. And so it makes perfect sense that these services exist to both, you know, assist clients in sorting through all the options to make the best choice and, you know, without having to do these crazy deep searches themselves or have to know the right people, as well as to give these influencers a way to connect with clients without having to be, you know, discovered as such.
I think my, you know, one of my concerns is, I guess, a bit more general in terms of how it's actually impacting creativity and creative work in general. And I think it's one of my favorite things that I always talk about when I'm giving a talk or giving advice is the Kevin Kelly article, 1,000 True Fans, which is Kevin Kelly, the former editor of Wired, kind of saying, okay, any artist or creative who gets 1,000 true fans can make kind of a living on that. And he wrote that, I mean, I don't know the exact date, but it was many years ago. So it seems like kind of influencer marketing is a natural kind of extension of that philosophy. But I think what concerns me is like, you know, I think it was originally 100 and then he upgraded to 1,000. It seems now that you really have to kind of feed that even more. And like 1,000 is not enough. Like, yeah, like for Instagram, it has to be kind of 60,000, 100,000. A million, and like
that. Well, that's if you're looking to make your money via influencer deals.
Well, yes, and that's why they're trying to now cut, you know, and find those kind of fake followers so much. That was interesting what Grace was talking about, finding, you know, where bot followers, you know, come from, or
probably scaring a lot of influencers knowing that they can see that now.
But I was looking at Seb Lester, who's a lettering artist that I kind of really enjoy, and I guess this is also why I picked this article, because of what happened with him last week, where he's you know, he kind of rose to popularity with all of his kind of calligraphic logos.
I also posted this in the chat.
What?
If you're about to talk about what I think you're about to talk about.
I have been moving house this week. I have not looked at anything. I am also on Instagram, Lara.
Are you, Jeremy?
I also follow Seth.
Are you?
We are just very smart people who happen to be on the same wavelength. So
I'm sure.
Yes.
Just take credit for everything I do. Go, Jeremy.
Anyway, so what happened was, you know, Seb started this new account kind of using an iPad app to make these kind of heraldic
Sort of kaleidoscopic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, I think he was feeling a bit frustrated that he wasn't getting enough engagement kind of on those posts. And then he did kind of just a drawing of the poop emoji, which kind of like immediately went viral and kind of, you know, got so much engagement, so many hits. And he wrote this really interesting post about, like, you know, like, why did the, you know, like, I just found it funny that that happened. And I think you kind of see that in terms of, well, if that's kind of, if people are kind of really driven for engagement, and all of the social media platforms and even art sharing platforms are designed to kind of get that dopamine hit of people kind of interacting with it, you're going to be searching, or you're going to be deliberately trying to create work that's going to get likes or get engagement rather than what you might want to kind of naturally explore.
Yeah, that's a terrifying thought. And I think that's totally true.
I mean, and oh God, I mean, how many times do we see this with fashion illustrators where it's like, I don't want to kind of name any specific names, but like, yeah, we work with some of the best fashion illustrators have amazing followers, and we've seen them completely ripped off wholesale, or, you know, just poor attempts at kind of ripping them off. And yet these people have, like, you know, 30,000-40,000 kind of followers, and they're getting commissioned for work. And the work is not doing anything. It's not adding anything to, you know, to the creative bottom line, or doing anything. They're just doing it because they're kind of an influencer. So I think it's, look, again, this is my old man fish shaking thing about influencers. Like, I think there's a lot of good that can come of it. I think if creators can kind of get behind that 1,000 true fans, and like, yeah, you want to engage a community, and I think that's all kind of well and good. But I think also, you know, this is my kind of cautionary tale for kind of creatives, to make sure that there is kind of a safe space to kind of explore, to do work that is really boring, really bad, and, you know, just to, you know, follow your bliss, man.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. I mean, yeah, it's a funny thing, because in a lot of ways I agree completely with what you're saying, and then in certain ways I actually really like some elements of influencer marketing when the influencer is someone who is who has promised to only take on deals for things that they actually like, products they actually actually
trust
in.
To kind of maintain their integrity.
Exactly, to maintain that integrity. And in that sense, I actually really like it, because it's a review I can genuinely trust. And, well, you know, I feel that I can genuinely trust it more than I can trust other people. Like, for example, if I see someone, I think we talked about this with Grace as well, but there's this chick, Alana Davison, who I love, who's just like a makeup blogger chick, but she's great. And, you know, when she does do endorsed products, sponsored product stuff, I trust her a lot because A, I know that she only sort of takes on ones that she like, she tries and tests them before she will ever talk about it at all. And she will say bad things if she doesn't like it. And B, I trust her more than like a random friend of mine, because what the hell does a random friend of mine have to compare against? This woman has tried, you know, every skincare product on the face of the planet. So I trust when she says this is the best.
I think it's more about how those things are kind of happening though. It's like, you know, if a company is approaching someone to kind of put content into kind of their feed, like I kind of feel that's where it's kind of like, I think there are ways for brands to get messages out there and for marketing influencer agencies to kind of also, you know, get this content to these kind of valuable audiences. But I feel like maybe the way the way it's happening, like from the brand into the feed, could potentially be reversed or looked at in a different way. Like maybe it could go the other way. Okay, well, that was a really great wrap up, I think, of, you know, what's been happening in our feed and in the industry. It was really fun chatting with you all. Before we end, we will go and still talk about the most Melbourne and the most New York thing that's happened to us this week. Laura, what do you got?
This is probably, I think this would run true throughout Australia, but I just felt so Aussie. I loved it. I went to the movies on Sunday. Well, I tried to go to the movies to see Three Billboards. And about 10 minutes into the film, the power cut out in the cinema. So like
cool.
Everything went black. Like just the screen went off and all the lights everywhere went black. And no one like panicked or anything, but all you heard like as soon as, because it cut at this sort of like, I don't know, there's like this intense conversation happening and it just cut. And all you hear is this woman in the front go, "Oh, fuck right off." And everyone just pissed themselves laughing. And I just thought that was so beautifully Australian.
That really is. Oh, B, what do you got?
I mean, I moved house recently, and for the first time in, I think since I moved out of home, there is a television in my apartment. So I've been watching a lot of television, a lot of keeping up with
you've always been that person that's like, I don't have a TV.
Yeah. But now I've like watched every episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians that I have access to, and The Bachelor. Can I just say, American advertising is so bizarre. So especially, Jeremy, I don't know if this was a thing when you were living in the States, but especially TV commercials for prescription drugs.
You know, I haven't seen any of those. Like, I think when there was some great animation and illustration, especially for antidepressants. And there's also that amazing thing that John Oliver was doing about the catheter guy, where he was. Did you guys see that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Anyway, but no, what's on at the moment, B?
I mean, the standard right now for prescription drug advertising, and even like, I guess it's weird because prescription medication in Australia isn't advertised. So number one, that's the first bizarre thing. But like the kind of standard commercial that sort of happens is it's essentially stock footage of beautiful people living beautiful, happy lives, just kind of like running in the background, you know, doing their thing. But then over the top, they run these bizarre voiceovers that have to run through all of the weird and wonderful and sometimes just downright hilarious side effects of, you know, what happens when you take certain medications. Those things like, you know, like tell your doctor immediately if you develop puffiness in your face, diarrhea, changes in urine, swelling of your stomach area. And it's just like
a list is really long.
Yeah, just like contrasted between these like just beautiful people.
Oh my God. There's an amazing SNL skit from ages ago called Happy Fun Ball, which does a great parody of this. Like this is not a new complaint, and it's something that has been done very, very well. If we can find that, we'll put it in the show notes. It's entirely worth it. My Melbourne thing is I have moved house this week, which has been a terrible experience. But I've been using this certain removalist company that I don't want to buzz market at the moment. But Schman with a Schman. I'm kind of curious. I don't know if this is a Melbourne thing or if this is just a universal moving thing. But it seems like every time I get like the same two movers, just like in different bodies. And it's always the Muso and the Irishman.
Oh my God. The big guy and the little guy.
The big guy and the little guy.
I've definitely had the Muso and the Irishman.
I always just get the big guy and the little guy, and you expect the little guy to be shit, but he can lift.
The little guy, yes.
The little guy can lift.
The little guy always lifts more than the big guy because maybe, yeah, the big guy, you know, grew up big. Maybe people put all those expectations
exactly.
on him, like be a big lifter.
Whereas this guy is trying to challenge your expectations.
He's got something to prove.
Exactly.
I think we'll leave it there. Thanks, B.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks.
This has been Jackie Winder Gives You the Business. Jackie Winder Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Arij Noor. You can find the Jackie Winder Group on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Behance at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, if you want to have the next episode that we do of MiniLinks named after you, email us your naming suggestions and we will pick the best one and name the episode after you. Just email us podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and all of our show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/jackiewinter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye. She thinks I'm in the game
because I'm out of brain when she hears me sing. I was making fun of you behind your back before, Jeremy, for doing the real dad move of like talking real loud every time you're on the phone.
You should talk. You're the loudest in the office.
That's probably true.
Oh my God. Okay.
Okay.
And I was on noise-canceling headphones. That's why I was so loud. Sorry about that. I will have to fix that.
It's fine.